Joy. This is Joy Peterson, and I'm taping for the Kentucky Heritage Quilt Society. This is the Quilters on File interview with Midge Gaith in her home in Anchorage, Kentucky. The date is February 6, 1984, and the number of this particular interview is 13, JDP 13. Midge, do I have your permission to do this tape?
You surely do.
Thank you. Would you please tell us your name and spell it in full for us?
You want my proper name?
If you don't mind giving it to us.
Okay. It's Mildred Ann Gaith, M-I-L-D-R-E-D, Ann, A-N-N, Gaith, G-O-E-T-H.
Thank you. And would you tell us where we are, where we are in your home and where your home is?
Okay, we're in my living room. This is 311 Summit Court, Middletown, Kentucky.
That's Jefferson County.
Jefferson County.
Right,
absolutely.
Right. How long have you lived here?
Be 3 years in April.
Did you live in some other home in this community, or are you just 3 years in Kentucky?
No. I'm a native of Kentucky.
Are you?
Grew up about a mile and a half down the road. Actually was born down in the West End. Mm-hmm. Norton's Infirmary, which of course is now Norton's Children's Hospital, I believe.
Right.
But I lived until I was about 8 years old, down in the West End on Market Street.
Whereabouts on Market?
And I'm not Market, let me see, 213 West 43rd Street. That's what it was, right off Market Street.
Is that called Portland?
No, that's not quite the Portland area. Now, my parents were both natives, I guess you would say, of the Portland area.
Really?
And grew up on Dumanil and Duncan and those areas down
really?
There.
Really? Uh-huh.
But then we moved out to the Dorsey Way, down the road here on Shelbyville Road when I was about 8 years old, and then have lived in this area. I have lived in the area on and off since that time. My parents have just moved, they're about five blocks from me now, down here, and so they've been here all their lives.
I didn't realize that.
Yep.
A native Kentuckian. I was thinking I was coming to interview someone from the East. We'll
people, yeah, when I talk about what I did before I came here, a lot of folks think that I was originally from the East.
How long were you in the East?
On and off, Joy, for about 15 years. I left here shortly after college and just came back 5 years ago.
Oh, well, let's see about your education then. Where did you go to grade school, high school? What was college?
Okay. I don't even remember the name. Oh, yes, I do. Shawnee Elementary, where I started kindergarten, just practically outside my back door when I lived in the West End. And then I went to Linden Elementary right out here from the third through the sixth grade. And at that time, of course, we didn't have middle schools as we know them today. And right from the sixth grade, I went to the great big old Eastern High School. And the seventh grade, and there through the 12th. And then went to Kentucky Wesleyan College down in Owensboro and received my BA down there.
And what courses did you take?
Oh gosh, everything. I was one of those who couldn't decide what she wanted to major in. Consequently, I think I changed my major three times, graduated with 140 hours or something ridiculous like that.
Well, what kind of courses?
And still didn't do anything in my major.
It wasn't in art.
No. I wish it had been at that point. My mother wishes that it had been. My aunt is a very fine artist, and you know, they kept trying to prod me all along, but I got sidetracked somewhere along the way.
Well, did you take art in high school?
Yes, I did take art in high school. Just the elementary courses primarily, but I did. Mrs. Clark, I'll never forget her for some reason. I think she was ancient. But she was quite a good art teacher.
And this was, Miss Clark taught where?
At Eastern.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But you still didn't take this as a significant idea to go to college?
No. At that point, I think I was just more of a hobby than anything.
What were your career thoughts, do you think, as you left high school and tried college?
Really didn't have any. You know, I think my mother just knew how very important it was for me to have a college education. And while I was in school, I was minoring in science, and I really wanted to get into the medical field in some fashion. And unfortunately, at that time, my family was not in a situation to send me on after 4 years, and Dad said, you know, if you're going to go on, we'll do what we can to help, but you're going to have to do a lot of it on your own. So that's why I got a teaching certificate. And I taught for 3 weeks. I knew it wasn't for me. So,
where did you teach?
Westport High School, over on Westport Road.
What were you certified to teach in?
Well, I was certified to teach in science and phys ed, believe it or not. And that's not what I was teaching at Westport. And that's why I didn't last. I had an eighth grade core class, which involved me with, you know, with eighth graders. And that was another thing. I was certified for high school. So it didn't work out, needless to say. Mm. And from there, I went to the Courier Journal. And that's how I got started with the newspaper business, which, you know, I spent some time at the Washington Post. And really enjoyed that.
Well, we'll come back to the Washington Post, yeah. But I realized that we didn't get a chance to really establish how old you are when you were born. If you don't mind, we'd like to have that on the
table. Okay, I was born March 31st, 1942, which makes me 41 years old presently until next month.
Mm-hmm. And we wondered what your religious preference was?
Presbyterian.
And your parents, I would like to have their names on the tape.
Okay. My father is George Philip Gaith, and my mother is Winnie Lee. Her maiden name was McBride.
Would you spell McBride?
Capital M-C, capital B-R-I-D-E.
And her first name?
Winnie, W-I-N-N-I-E.
Thank you. Where were they born?
Louisville.
Both of them were.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you said that they
mm-hmm.
were from Portland.
Mm-hmm.
And your father's occupation?
He's been in the automobile business, in sales and management, since he was 17 years old.
And he's retired?
Oh, yes.
Uh-huh. And they live 6 months here?
Uh-huh. They're here for 6 months of the year, and then they're down in Cortez, Florida, during the winter months.
Have you ever been married?
Mm-hmm. I have.
And you're no longer married?
Correct.
Okay. Now, you say that after you finished college and tried a little bit of teaching, you ended up in the newspaper business. Perhaps we could pick up on your biography there.
Well, let's see. It was a short-lived career at the Courier Journal. I went in there just after only teaching for 3 weeks. You know, one needs to get out and get a job. And I was there as a receptionist clerk kind of gal in the advertising department. And I had seriously considered at that point getting into advertising. And my college roommate invited me up to her house for the weekend. She was living in Washington, D.C. at the time, for Memorial Day weekend or something like that. And I went and met the man that was soon to become my husband, and that's why my career at the Courier Journal was short-lived, because I soon picked up sticks and then moved to Washington. and I worked there as in his business, which was the employment agency business. And after we were married, it was one of those situations, you know, where husband and wife working together and just got to be a little bit too much. And I looked then to the Washington Post, having enjoyed the short experience that I had at the Courier Journal, and got into the personnel department and was there for a short period of time, about 2.5 years, I guess. At which time, my husband and I decided that we would sail this 40 6-foot boat that we had down the Virgin Islands.
Can we put a date on what when we're talking about?
Well, let's see. We left.
What date were you married?
Okay, in 65. November 65. Mm-hmm. In June of 68, we left for the Virgin Islands. Actually, we didn't leave for the Virgin Islands. That's where we ended up. But we, his family still had some property on two tiny little Dutch islands south of St. Thomas. St. Martin and, not St. Martin, Saba and St. Eustatius. And it was our dream and adventure to go down there and renovate that property because none of the family lived there anymore. They all lived back in New York. And we were going to turn into guest houses and restaurants and that kind of thing, which that island at that time had none of.
I mean, so you no quit your job?
Yeah. Just pulled up stakes and left.
Now, what was your husband's name?
Bruce Johnson.
Okay.
So we got about as far as St. Thomas and had problems with the boat and, you know, blown out sails and, oh, engine problems and all that kind of thing. As far as St. Thomas having run out of money at that point for all these major repairs that the boat needed. And so that's where we stayed. And we both got employment there and, you know, little by little. And he finally did get the boat down to St. Martin, and we chartered out of there for a while. And at that point, the marriage didn't work out any longer.
What do you mean you chartered out of there? What does that mean?
We rented the boat out for people.
But you crewed it?
No, we didn't. We did what they call bare boat charter, where you just furnish the boat with the necessities of towels and bedding and galley gear and that kind of stuff, and then hopefully you manage to get people who are experienced sailors. You try to look into that as much as possible, but we had some unfortunate experiences, and so that, you know, we didn't do that too very long, but it's a way to help the boat pay for itself, and we were able to get money for repairs, you know, and that kind of thing. Comedy of errors from there on, but then I came back to the States in 71.
Were you divorced at that point?
No, we were separated at that point. We had another 2 years before we actually divorced.
So, how did you, what kind of employment did you find when you were down in the Virgin Islands?
That's where I got my retailing experience. I worked for a delightful Japanese lady, Tomiko Kakizaki. Her name, however, at that point was Rivera. She married a Puerto Rican.
Well, I think we need some spelling for the best that you can do at this point.
Tomiko, T-O-M-I-K-O. Her name at that point was Rivera, which I think is R-I-V-E-R-I-A.
You mean that's her husband's last name?
That was her husband's last name. And but her Japanese name was Kakizaki, which she has since taken back since she divorced.
Can you spell Kakizaki?
No.
It'll have to be spelled on the index, so whatever you do.
I've got it in a letter. You want me to go get it?
Yes.
You want to put a stop on that?
No, I don't put a stop on it.
Okay.
Don't worry about it.
Right,
don't worry about it taking extra time. We just let it run when we're looking something up.
Kakizaki, K-A-K-I-Z-A-K-I.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Appreciate you getting that for us. She was the one that introduced you into retailing. Is that where we found her?
She had, now envision this, on the island of St. Thomas, tropical island, the only retail outlet for ladies' foundation wear and sleepwear. Up until the point that she opened her business, the native St. Thomian ladies got their brassieres and girdles and panties at the local general store, you know, and it was play tax in a box, and that was all they could get. And if it fit, fine. If it didn't, that was just too bad. So she felt, she saw a need for the local ladies as well as a great tourist trade. And she bought a lot of the American lines, you know, Vanity Fair and Form Fit Rogers and all those good people, as well as imported some lovely things from Spain and Italy with the duty-free idea, you know, once again, and captured the tourist market, as well as having a good, solid foundation trade from the local ladies. But I don't know, I took one look at this gal, and I guess Tomiko at that time was about 40, 41, and looking at her correspondence, her very broken English, and how she corresponded with business, and I thought, if this woman can do it, I can do it. And not that I had a great burning desire at that time to do it, but I knew that it was there if I wanted to. And we had a very, very close relationship, and not just as an employer and employee, but became very fast friends, and to this day still correspond.
Now, what year what year were we talking about?
When I was down there with, working with her, 68 to 71, late 70 actually, I left, very end of December.
I interrupted 70. You. You were saying you've had a good correspondence or a good relationship, but you've had...
Well, like so many other of those types of relationships, you know, you... There are years sometimes that go by without any correspondence at all, and we have just picked up after about a 4-year absence from one another, finding that she's back in Japan, which I think is good for her.
But she's shocked that you're putting together a quilt store out here.
She probably has no idea what a quilt store is.
Oh dear,
so that's why we need to get together and talk.
Mm-hmm.
She is fulfilling, though, right now, as this last letter indicated, what an ambition that I knew she had then, and that was to go back to higher education. And she was from the northernmost island in Japan called Hokkaido. Very primitive little island, probably one of the very last to get into the Western culture of any kind, you know, I mean, when she, one of the reasons she left, she said she was the original Japanese hippie, and that, you know, she just couldn't adhere entirely to their traditions. And but she's back now in Tokyo, going to college.
Really?
And she's got to be in her 50s now. So she's quite, has been an inspiration to me, and I think continues to be.
Yes, ma'am. Now, what year did you and Bruce get divorced?
Oh, let's see. I guess about 72 or 3.
By then you're back in this country for a year or so.
Right.
And
right.
What did you do when you came back to this country? Did you go back to the Washington Post?
Mm-hmm. Sure did. And that's when they began seeing a need for women in their sales department. And I was one of the first 3 women that they hired in the outside sales division, retail sales division. That's again where I saw, where I put my retailing experience to use, working with retailers and learning a bit about the advertising business as well.
Where did you live?
Silver Spring, Maryland.
Well, where did you make this transition from the newspaper trade to retail?
One of my customers was a store very similar to what I have now here in Louisville. And I watched these gals start in a room over a house, you know, second floor of a house in Bethesda, Maryland. And at that time, they were primarily interested in primitive Appalachian craft and art.
Do you recall the name of their store?
Appalachiana. And then they finally got a storefront in the first floor of an office building in Bethesda, in the heart of Bethesda. And then from there they grew again. And this whole time I was their sales rep for the Washington Post. And I enjoyed helping them merchandise, you know, after we'd select an ad to run in the Post, then I'd help them merchandise it in the store. And in addition to instead of my big accounts, I really liked my little accounts like that, where I could get some hands-on feeling for what they were doing and understand their budgets and how their operations work. And quite frankly, I sat down one January to sell them an ad in our February Sunday supplement.
What year was this?
Oh, gosh, what year was this? 73. No, that was 74. It was January 74. And they sold me the business.
10 years ago.
Uh-huh. Now, they didn't sell me their business. They sold me I hesitate to call it a franchise because it was, you know, not a McDonald's type idea. We opened a second store is what we did. And that's when I went over to the Eastern Shore of Maryland. They were in Bethesda, and we had looked at going all the way around the other side of the Beltway and opening a branch in Virginia. But you know, I'm a Kentuckian and I'm from a small town, and to be perfectly truthful, the large city life of Washington, I've had enough of. And I saw this as a means to get out of the Washington area and to still fulfill that little urge that I had to be self-employed and go into the retail business. So by this time, the business had expanded to include quilts and some fabric, and they had seen a need developing in the Washington area very rapidly. They took then the space next to them and opened up almost another 3,000 square feet with nothing but fabric and quilts and all the related paraphernalia. And of course, I think we're just beginning to see this in other parts of the country today. And that just, to me, shows how far the coast was, how far advanced they were to the quilting idea at that time. Mm-hmm. But when I opened in Maryland, I was in Easton, Maryland. When I opened there, didn't have a real big clientele for the quilting. And I had such a small spot that I really didn't have room to hang quilts properly. But we had maybe 30, 40 bolts of fabric, and we would have one or two instructors come over from Washington on Saturday afternoons and teach classes. We just began to introduce it really to that area. And had I known a little bit more then, like I do now, I would have really started to hunt for the old quilts there, because I found they were everywhere, just everywhere. But you know, that's what hindsight is always better than foresight, or that they say. But so I just began to get into it really on the Eastern Shore.
What was the name of that show?
The same, Appalachiana.
It was a franchise.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And the size, can you give us an estimated size of that shop?
Oh, golly. I think actual square footage was only about 800. Not even quite 800 square feet. Even at that, I had to knock out walls between two stores and, you know, go up a level. But I was selling there primarily the handmade crafts.
What type of handmade crafts? Like pottery?
Pottery, weaving, toys, blown glass.
Where did you get the names of the people that were to become the suppliers of these crafts?
Well, of course, I started with a nucleus from the gals in Bethesda. And from there, I went to craft fairs primarily in the area, which were prolific. Went on up into the New England areas for craftsmen, mostly East Coast.
Were you bringing Kentucky things in at that point?
Yes. Did a great deal of business with Berea. People there were just fascinated with what was coming out of Kentucky. And I bought at that point just about everything that Berea sold.
Were you in a position where you had to pay a certain percentage to these people that were in Bethesda?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I did. I paid a percentage of my monthly gross. And that's the only connection we had, really, as a franchise. After the first year, when I got established and they helped me, you know, to do that, then I did a lot of the buying on my own. The percentage went down. Startup knowledge, of course, I paid more for in the beginning.
How long did you have this relationship with them? The whole time you were there in Houston?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Are there other things that we should touch on as far as that store before we move you back here? I assume we're going to move you back
mm-hmm.
here now.
You are. I don't think so.
So when did you conclude that relationship and get this one developed here?
Let's see. I sold that business then to one of my employees.
How many employees did they have? And
okay.
Under what circumstances?
I had one full-time and two part-time employees. A high school kid once in a while, you know, that kind of thing, in addition to those. But I sold that business to one of my employees. She and the gals that owned Appalachiana decided that they did not want that contact anymore, the franchise. So she renamed her store American Penny Royal and is on her own completely. Has changed the complexion of it considerably, which you might understand would be done, you know, as different personalities of different owners take over.
Is Penny Royal two words or one word?
One word.
What was her name?
Lainey, L-A-I-N-I-E, Milky, M-I-E-L-K-E.
What year did you, or what month and year? We were February 1974, I think, that you
mm-hmm.
got this brainstorm with
mm-hmm.
the retailing.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
we
what
opened,
year did
we
you?
Opened in June of 74. And I sold it to Lainey in February of 79 and opened my business here in June of 79.
Did you look at, or let's establish what your business here is. We've not touched on this, Midge, and that's,
mm-hmm.
we're pretty far along in this tape not to actually establish that you are a proprietress of a shop. So would you give us some background as far as where your shop is and this
mm-hmm.
sort of thing?
It's in the Stonefield Square Shopping Center on Shelbyville Road. The address is 10418 Shelbyville Road.
Your name?
American Accents. And I opened there in June the 4th, 1979.
Did you look at other locations? How did you decide?
Looked all over the city for a good 6 months. I don't know if it was because I grew up right across the street. You know, it's hard to look in your own backyard. And I kept thinking, no, you know, I can't have any business in this part of town. I need to be over in Brownsboro Road or Bardstown Road. You know, I looked over in those areas. Even looked at the Galleria. Of course, the Galleria was still in planning stages at that point. We were still buying property downtown, but my mother still said, nobody's ever going to go downtown. Don't go down there.
And what about Bakery Square?
Yes, Bakery Square. Looked there. And kept driving past Stonefield Square under construction, you know. And people, even my realtor would say, well, you know, there's a nice little shopping center out there right close to where your parents live. And I said, mm-hmm. And I just kept on going. And then actually what happened was there was nowhere else in town. There was nothing else new under construction, and to wait Holiday Manor was where I really thought I wanted to be. And to wait for somebody to vacate there, you know, I had no idea when that would be. So, process of elimination, I found myself at Stonefield Square and don't regret the decision at all. It's been a very good location.
Did I gather from something I heard prior to our tape that you, part of the reason you returned to the Lowell community was because of your parents?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Had a small scare father medically. And it was just one of those things. I had been thinking, even while I was on the Eastern Shore, that I was probably going to come back to the Louisville area. I just didn't know when. I hadn't made any firm goal plans at that time, you know, to come back to the Louisville area. And my father had retired and just had a little bit of a scare, which fortunately proved not to be serious. But it was enough to get those thought processes moving even faster. Having left right after college, and I assume, you know, you just don't think about those things, of course, when you're that age. And all of a sudden, I just realized I didn't know my parents since I was an adult. And I felt the need for that.
Have you any siblings?
I had a brother, and I suppose that was another reason I felt the need to come back. He died 23 years ago this month. And that was another reason, because I felt like I wanted to be close to home.
This is side two, tape one, February 6th. Joy Peterson interviewing Midge Gaith, Jefferson County, Kentucky, for the Kentucky Heritage Quilt Society. Midge, we were discussing your folks and how old they were,
mm-hmm.
and whether they were in good health.
Yeah.
Would you start on that again, please?
Mm-hmm. They're enjoying very good health right now. I guess if I were living in Florida 6 months out of the year, I would too. Dad is 70, and Mother will be 69 in May this year.
And you said you had a brother who died 23 years
mm-hmm.
ago.
Mm-hmm.
At the age of 23. He was a victim of cancer. He was married and had a little daughter at the time who is now expecting her first child. And we're just all very, very excited about that. We'll make Mother and Dad great grandparents and me a great aunt. And she lives close by. She's in Carrollton, Kentucky.
Did you have children?
No.
I feel that there might be more that we want to discuss about your store before we go into anything about your personal quilting and your personal artwork. When you opened your store, how did you come up with your name?
That's the hardest part of any business, I've come to believe. Originally, it was my intention. I felt Louisville lacked a good resource for American handcrafts, quality American handcrafts. Not that the Kentucky crafts were not a quality item, but there was no store, no retail source here for crafts from all over the country. So that was my intent. And of course, being from the coast and bringing most of my craftsmen from that area at the time, and knowing that Berea was so close, I knew I didn't want to sell the Berea crafts here. People enjoy making that Sunday afternoon drive down to Berea to do that. And I really didn't want to call it a gallery, even though a lot of people classify it as a gallery of crafts, because I had a feeling that very often the word gallery had a connotation that frightened some people, inhibited them in the point of, you know, oh, I can't afford that. And we were not that. We had, you know, items from a dollar up. So it was difficult. Madeline and I had to put our heads together, and we came up with American accents because we felt that I knew that no matter what ever transpired, it would always be an American-made product. If not, I wouldn't be there. That's just the way I felt about it at the time. So the name.
Now you have that great Japanese connection.
Right. Well, you see, my idea there is to take American crafts and sell them in Japan.
We got into the quilting aspect of things almost through the back door. If you'd like to get into this now.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I knew Donna and Bryce Hamilton from my experiences in Maryland. They had come to the Eastern Shore and did a quilt show for us, which we did at the Tidewater Inn, which was a little inn, historic inn, right across the street. And we rented a room there and hung quilts and sold quilts for 4 days and just had a marvelous time. And Donna and Bryce at that time were touring the country in their van with their collection to sell, as well as some of their own private collection. And just stayed in touch with them, even though I didn't have the room in my own store to sell, display and sell their quilts. The minute I moved down here and I had all those lovely walls, the first thing I did was call Donna and Bryce Hamilton. And I got quite a few quilts from them on a consignment basis to sell. And I thought, well, to enhance these quilts, I should probably have a couple bolts of fabric. And so I bought about 20 or 30 bolts of fabric and put them on the shelves, and lo and behold, they were gone in no time at all. Because people kept telling me there's nowhere else in Louisville where we can get good cottons. Well, I knew Bears was an established fabric store downtown, and surely they had good cottons. And they did, but they were not dedicating themselves at that time to the quilter. And I suppose I resisted it all along the way, and I don't know why, because I absolutely love it. And, you know, as you well know, Joy, I get in more and more each year trying to get more into the quilting supplies and classes and everything else that's involved in quilting in this community. So that's sort of how it started, came to be.
I think we need to pick up back there. You said Madeline, and our tape doesn't know who Madeline is, so let's go back to that.
That's kind of an interesting story. Madeline Conroy.
Let's spell that.
M-A-D-A-L-Y-N. Conroy. C-O-N-R-O-Y.
Who is Mrs.?
Mrs. James, J.T., James Thomas Conroy. She worked with me at the store in Easton. And her husband, after graduating from Penn State in turf management, took a job at Hurstbourne Country Club here in Louisville. And you know, it was one of those things that at the time he was applying, his resume was going all over this country, and finally settled on Hurstbourne, and I was just so excited. I said, Madeline, you'll just live right down the street from my mother and dad. And you know, just the whole thing was ironical. And so they moved here. And that was a year before things developed to the point that I wanted to come back. And Madeline had told me right away, you know, Mitch, you're just going to have to keep sending these lovely pots and things down to me because there's nowhere in Louisville to buy them. So I called her in August of that very next year and said, what would you think of another store?
That would have been 78.
Mm-hmm. And so she really helped me a great deal being here. And, you know, beginning to get in touch with realtors and lawyers and all those people that you need to deal with. And then when I finally made the decision to come, and she helped me find the location. And I would come down for a weekend and do what I could and then go back, and you know, she would sort of pick up during the week and help find paper suppliers and printers and all those things that need to be done when you open your business. And so, of course, she was right on hand and just jumped right in. We were a team again here in Louisville.
You and Madeline have been partners?
No. I prefer to call her an associate. She's never had a financial interest in the business.
Is she still as involved in the business as she was at the beginning?
No, she's not. She had her first child while we were still in Maryland. And Ryan is 7 years old now. And she has had her second child 2 years ago. Michael was born here in Louisville 2 years ago. She's a good mother, dedicated mother, and she prefers to be at home more with them now than she does to be with me, but I understand that.
She still is associated.
Oh, she sure is, yeah. She's always there in spirit, and she works part-time now.
And who else do you employ in the store? Do you have many employees? I
have part-time, two other part-time gals on a regular basis, and that is Ruthie Baumrucker. Do you want me to spell
yes,
these names?
Thank you.
Her name is Ruth, but we all call her Ruthie, R-U-T-H-I-E. Baumrucker, B-A-U-M-R-U-C-K-E-R. Another good German name. And Mert Brown. Mert is Mercedes, but we call her Mert, M-E-R-T, Brown, B-R-O-W-N. They are on a regular part-time basis. And then, of course, I have the teaching staff.
How many on your teaching staff?
Oh, golly. Of what I call the regulars, there are four or five.
They would be Barbara Hart, Patty Daniel.
I wouldn't consider Patty one of
let
the
you
regulars. Okay. And I guess I call them the regulars because they're the ones that teach the introductory classes. And we have more of the introductory classes than anything else. And those four are Barbara Harp, Mary Pat Carroll, Mary Lee Younger, and new gal, the very strong teacher that we have right now is Marcia Pence. And they teach the introductory classes. And then the special technique classes, of course, as we offer them, those gals come in and teach. And they are Patty Daniel, who I think you've already interviewed, who teaches the advanced applique classes. And Star Kaiser, who has taught the Celtic design workshops and the children's workshops. And she has really been a great help with anything that we've done with children. Ellen Pillow's class, other special technique classes. She's done a very good job. Who else do we have? Of course, Pat Scoble is no longer with us. But I guess that's about it.
You initially talked about having a gallery, and you talked about crafts that you were in a unique position to furnish from the East Coast connection. And then with the Hamiltons and getting into quilts through the back door, your initial idea was more of the pottery and the crafts, that sort of thing. And then at one point, perhaps it was half and half, is now the real emphasis toward the quilters, or am I overstating that? Or can you evaluate?
I think it's still half and half. There are times of the year, just because of trends in retail sales, that it shifts from one division to the other. This time of the year, we, of course, are very heavy into the quilting aspect of things. November and December, obviously, being for the Christmas season, we sell more pottery than we do 40 yards of fabric. So I'd say all in all, it's 50-50, maybe 55-45 quilting.
Perhaps you'll think of other things while we're going on with the interview on your personal quilting that you'll want to tell us about American accents, but if there's something at this point that you'd like to mention, I'll be glad to give you a few moments to think about it.
I think one thing that I would like to talk about, and that's the reason, not only the personal reasons for going in more heavily to the quilting in terms of the dollar, you know, and what makes business, but my satisfaction in working with the women, the quilters. They come in all sizes, in all shapes, in all ages. We get feedback from the husbands and the boyfriends. And I think that's, I tell you, Joy, if we could ever tape just that, I think it would be fascinating. The things that I hear, the stories that I hear, a boyfriend's reaction to a wall quilt that was given for Christmas. You know, the girl, I had been working with her since August. You know, I don't know if he's going to like this. He's going to think this is dumb. You know, all of those reasons why it shouldn't be. And then to see the delight on both of their faces. You know, finally he's coming in now. What is this all about? And some husbands just sit around and nod their heads and, you know, pick up the pieces off the floor, please, you know. But then some of them are just very intrigued with what their women are doing. And the stories that we hear about grandmothers and grandfathers, and, you know, it, the connection to family through quilting is phenomenal, I think. And this is what pleases me. I love hearing that. And, you know, unfortunately, I guess, if I were a better businesswoman, I wouldn't do this, but I will stand for an awful long time and talk to people. But that's one of the satisfactions that I've had through enlarging the quilting division of American Quilt. And I don't think I'll ever cease that pleasure.
That's great. I appreciate you mentioning that. Well, Mitch, when did you learn to quilt?
I really don't know, Joy. It just sort of happened, I suppose. Grew out of necessity, you know, from the classes.
That reason?
Yes. I've always sewed, and you made my own clothing. So it wasn't that a needle and thread were new to me. And I can remember, even as a teenager, making my own bathing suits. I would embellish them in some way. You know, it just had to be different than what the other gals were wearing. But I guess through the classes and seeing Marion Godfrey, who was one of our very first instructors, and the pleasure that she got from it, and not only self-satisfaction, but again, the people contact for her was very important. And seeing the joy of the students and that kind of thing, and I thought, well, I think I'll try that. And after my first quilt market, I think, is really when I, for myself, realized that this is something that I would gain some self-satisfaction from.
Was this Houston in 1980?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Thank you. just sitting in on a couple of the workshops there, and it was first in apparel, because I think I felt comfortable with that, having made my own clothes up to this point, and seeing what they were doing with strip quilted vest and Seminole workshop under Cheryl Bradkin. You know, I just came home and was up to all hours, and I just thought that was wonderful. And little by little then it got into the wall pieces, and that's really as far as I've gone. I have machine pieced several full-size quilts, but I've yet to quilt one. It's in the works. It'll happen one day.
You say you always had a needle in your hand. How old were you when, was it a grandmother, your mother?
My mother.
Went to school?
Yeah, mm-hmm. All of the above, probably. Both of my grandmothers were wonderful seamstresses. My father's mother, in fact, I would have to go back to my aunt and find out the exact name, but she was one of the seamstresses for Louisville's leading dressmaker. And I don't remember that woman's name, but all of the elite in Louisville had their dresses made by this woman, and my grandmother worked for her.
What was your grandmother's name?
My grandmother's name was Rosa, R-O-S-A, Gaith, G-O-E-T. She was a fine needleworker, tatted and crocheted, and this year's quilt show will have one of her quilts. Beautiful, beautiful applique quilt. And she was the artist, and I'm sorry that she didn't do more in the quilting vein, because I think she could have done some, well, she did, the one we still have, a lovely piece. But she did, made her own lace, you know, that kind of thing. I have her nightgown from her wedding night, and it's all hand eyelet, you know, on the sleeves and this kind of thing. Now, my mother's mother made quilts for us to sleep under.
And her name?
Her name was Anna McBride. She was, I guess I would call a utilitarian quilter. And I didn't have a blanket until I went to college. We slept under stacks of quilts. And most of them my mother's mother had made.
Were they quilted or tied?
Quilted. Mm-hmm. Quilted. She had, I can see her now, in her tiny little dining room. Because the light was good. She had double windows there on the side of the house. And her quilting frame was right there beside the those windows.
Where did she live?
She lived on 44th Street. Not too many blocks from us. On the other side of Market Street. Until her husband died, and then she came to live with us after on Dorsey Way.
As you recall, her utilitarian quilts, were they made out of wool, old men's suiting,
cottons,
bead bags?
Cottons, primarily. She used scraps, what was left over from dressmaking. And I'm sure there was a point in time there during the Depression that, you know, even as the clothing wore out, she put them into quilts. She did try to color coordinate them. In fact, we still have a blue quilt of hers that had some of my grandfather's shirts in it, but she would buy then a solid blue fabric and, you know, try to tie it all together with one shade of solid blue. And my mother still had those quilts. And I think today, you know, I mean, I let my dog sleep on them, and we just had so many of them. It's just a classic example of, you know, that old thing.
Remember any of the patterns?
No. No, I don't. My grandfather helped her a great deal. He was a machinist for the Island Railroad.
And Mr. McBride's first name.
Anna's husband.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it'll come to me. Later, maybe.
If I pop up with a name, that's what it is.
That's
right.
That funny grandpa. That's all I can
right.
remember.
Of course. Well, Grandpa McBride was a
right.
machinist with the railroad.
Uh-huh, with L&M.
Mm-hmm.
And he had his own workshop in his basement as well. He had a lathe, woodworking lathe, and a lot of metalworking tools and that kind of thing. He made her templates.
Really? Out of metal?
Out of metal. And backed them with sandpaper. And my aunt, my mother's sister, just found a box full of all this stuff recently. And she said, Miss, do you think you'd want this? And I,
you know, yes, yes.
Instructions for her patterns and all that kind of thing. She still has it. I'm sure I will lay my hands on it one day. My aunt still has it. Because she wants to do some things with it too, which I'm glad. He did. She, you know, didn't do any of this marking around her fabric. She just laid that old template on a piece of cut right around the edge. And I can remember her making, and he even made her a table that had fold-up legs on it so it could stick behind the closet door someplace when she wasn't using it. And he put, engraved the ruler yardstick right on the edge of this table so that she could just sit there and cut right off that little table. And I can remember her making a trip around the world, postage stamp size, you know, inch squares. And I thought, how on earth does that woman know what she's doing? Because she would be sewing these long, skinny rows of things together. But then, over in the corner was a section that had already been put together, and you could see the pattern beginning to develop. And then I realized that all these little stacks that she had lined up across that table, she'd pick off the first one and sew it on, and she'd pick off the next one and sew it on, and that there was a very definite pattern. She knew what she was doing. And my mother to this day says, too, you know, why didn't I pay more attention to my mother? We just looked at her and said, silly woman, she's cutting up those little pieces of fabric and throwing them back together again.
Did your mother not quilt?
Not then. Since I've gotten involved in it, she's back to quilting and enjoying it very, very much. She's made, she's on her fourth quilt. Yeah.
Does she not only piece the tops, but also quilt?
Well, that's an interesting story. The first one she made was a grandmother's flower garden. And it was a beautiful doll. She had nicely coordinated all of her calicos and solids. And, oh, it was one of those projects that she didn't intend to finish overnight, and it was several years in the making. And then she just went out and bought some batting and put a backing on it. And, you know, she had no one to tell her how to do it or what she should buy. And she quilted it, and it must have taken her 3 years to quilt it. And she did it the old-fashioned way, going around every one of those hexagons. And her hexagons weren't large, but they weren't real small either. I guess they were, what's that, an inch and a half, 2 inches maybe at the most. I don't think they were 2 inches. And she swore up and down she would never quilt another quilt as long as she lived. So she made a bear paw after I got started at American Accents with things, and she decided she wanted to make another quilt, and I helped her put some colors together. And she would take a winter to piece, you know, and while she was down in Florida. And then she said, "Now you send this one away to one of your ladies, and you have her quilt, and I'm not going to quilt another quilt." And she, in the meantime, had met Pat Scovel and Barbara Harp and some of my instructors, and I'd taken her to a couple quilt shows, and she began asking more questions, and I soon realized that that first grandmother's flower garden she made, she quilted through fat baths, which is why she was having such a heck of a time with her quilting. And I said, "Mother, you used the wrong kind of batting. And gee, why don't you do this?" And Barbara Harper was giving her a pointer or two, you know, while she was making her bear paw quilt. And so finally she said to me last year, "You know, I think I'll take that introductory quilting class. There are a few things I'm sure I could learn." I said, "Well, I'm sure you can." So I gave it to her for her birthday. And she quilted her piece, which is hanging in the store right now as a sample. It has got so much quilting on it, you would not know that this was the lady who said, "I will never quilt another quilt." And it just goes to show you, you know, learning a few tricks from other quilters and having the proper materials. So in Florida right now, she's quilting her fourth quilt.
What's the pattern?
Starlight. Mm-hmm. And it's based on the 8-point star. It's one of those patterns that, you know, it's got other squares and mm-hmm. rectangles in it, of course, and as it develops, other patterns develop
yeah.
too.
We can turn that off when you get your phone.
It's probably.
Well, we were interrupted for a moment with the telephone, and I did turn this off. We were talking about your mother learning to, or taking some courses, and then, or getting some pointers, and she is now down in Florida quilting a quilt called Starlight. The pattern is called Starlight. Was there more you wanted to say about that?
No, I'm just happy that she's doing it. I think it's just another link in the tradition of quilt making, handing it down from generation. However, I guess that was a gap. And I've found, just talking with my customers, I find that that's not unusual. And my own observations purely, I have a feeling that it had something to do with the Depression. My mother did not want anything that smacked of old. You know, she suffered through that, and now we're, let's put that behind us, let's have new things. And, but she's back to within the tradition of needleworking, I think. You know, it's buying new fabrics, and it's more of a hobby, a pleasure, an art form. My mother's one of those who was surrounded by sisters and sister-in-laws who were very artistically inclined, and Mom says, "Well, I can cook," you know, but she'd never felt she had a creative bone in her body. And she does. And it has emerged through her quilt making. And I'm just real pleased to see it. I think it's giving her satisfaction, and it certainly gives me satisfaction.
When you first started quilting, what was the first thing that you tried? What were your first patterns or your first
fabrics? It was on apparel, and I did some hand quilting on some vests. That was easy, I could hold. folded in my lap, and I was still not encumbered by that book. I did some pillow tops because I kept thinking I've got to learn what this hoop's all about. And I did some pillow tops, quilted them, and joy, I really don't remember. Because you know what, it's one of those things that was never finished. You know, I did it as a learning tool more than anything. I take that back. I do remember it was Drucker's Path.
What projects have you done as you progress through to today?
I've gone off on a contemporary vein, primarily. As I began to read books and realize that we didn't have to stay within the confines of traditional established patterns, I found that I liked playing with graph paper. And got this idea that if I were going to do something, I was going to do something different than anyone else did. But it's like going back to my bathing suits, you know. They had to be a little bit different than what anybody else had. And I began primarily just playing around with design. And the real test of that was when I committed to do a piece for Citizens Fidelity Bank in downtown Louisville. And after I committed myself to do it, I got real cold feet. I thought, have I bit off more than I can chew? But I struggled through it, and it was good that I did. It really gave me the confidence to go on to other things. And in fact, that's the reason primarily that I went down to the Jenny Beyer seminar at Hilton Head last January. Because I had this design on paper and had no earthly idea on how to make it happen.
This is Joy Peterson. I'm taping Mitch Gaith. It's JDP number 13. Today is February 6th, 1983. We're in Jefferson County for CAGE-QS, Quilters on File Project. This is tape two, side one. Midge, we were talking about your commission that you did for Citizens Fidelity Bank. And we were mentioning the fact that, you were mentioning the fact, that in January 1983, you went down to Hilton Head to a Jenny Beyer workshop. Mm-hmm. So let's pick up on that and start over with that thought.
Okay. I went down there primarily, well, Jenny Beyer and her technique, and you know, it was very, very big then, still is, I'm sure. But from her books, I realized that she was probably the master technician at this point in time of quilt making. And I felt that could help me, give me some ideas on how I was going to put this piece together. Even though it was abstract, where Jenny is very symmetrical, I think, you know, and I don't know how else you would define her kind of work, but because of what she had done with graph paper, and you know, I mean, she had explored some avenues that other people had, and I thought, well, perhaps I could learn something down there on how I'm going to put this together. So I took my drawings with me, and knowing that I was going to be working primarily in solids on this piece, the fabrics that I took with me were solids. And make a long story short, I felt like I was in the right church but the wrong pew. Everybody was working in Jenny Beyer fabrics and, you know, dark colors and this kind of thing, and but I did learn. And what I learned was not to be afraid to try something new. And what was Ellen's last name? Who was my breakout leader down there, really gave me a great deal of help in that feeling. It took me 3 days to get up my nerve just to show it to anybody. You know, I thought, because it wasn't like anything that anybody else was working on. They were all working on their medallions and, you know, their borders that were very related to their medallions, and what I had just, you know, was completely abstract. But once I did show it to Ellen, I can't think of her name at the moment, she was just fascinated with it. And she sat down with me on our own free time and gave me some good ideas. And the fears that I had, she said, well, that you're just going to have to work with it. You know, I knew I was going to end up with all bias edges on this quilt. There was no way I could get around it. And she said, you're right. You know, that's just part of your design. Learn to live with it. Maybe think about that next time before you design again. But the fact that you are aware that it has bias edges, you know, it's not going to be a surprise to you. So that really was what gave me the courage to go on with it, and that I wasn't completely out in left field with the kind of design that I wanted to do. And so I went ahead and did it and pieced it myself, and had Anita Doolin, who is a local quilt maker here in Louisville, quilt it for me. And it is hanging, you know.
And the size?
About 60 by 80.
And where is it hanging?
It's hanging in their branch bank in the Galleria complex, the Meininger Tower, Citizens Fidelity branch.
And the color scheme?
Color scheme is their office, which is wine, beige, maroons, even some rust.
Yeah. Is it 100% cotton?
Yes. Yes.
Polyester bat?
Mm-hmm. I tried to work with the angular shapes of the atrium of the Galleria as viewed from the outside. And whether it works or not, I don't know. I think it did.
Oh, I think it does. It's beautiful. Have there been any men in your family that have quilted?
Don't think so.
When you're quilting, how much time do you spend quilting?
You mean at one sitting or on a project or?
At one sitting.
At one sitting, daily. Gosh. Well, last night I sat down at 9 and got up at 2 in the morning.
Let's see.
I think I'll call this On My Golden Pond quilt, you know? That's, let me think about that a minute, because of what I do in the store. You know, I am involved with it daily, whether it's really hands-on for myself, my own satisfaction, I'm not able to do that daily.
Mm-hmm.
When I get involved in a project, like my Galleria quilt, I'll take a week off of work, and then I'm working almost all day on that project.
Would you have worked on it while you were in the store?
No.
Do you ever take these projects and work on them at the store?
No.
Where do you quilt?
Right here.
On your living room couch, watching television?
Mm-hmm.
Primarily. And usually it's of an evening, unless you're on a project where you've taken a week off,
yes,
as you said, with the,
yes,
commission.
Right, right. But since I do a lot, I do a lot of machine piecing, and of course all the apparel is by machine. And I did just finish this fall my third bedroom, and that's my sewing room.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I do have it.
Mm-hmm.
I do have that set up now.
Where do you get your quilt designs?
Oh golly. We carry, 75 titles of books in the store? And whenever the new ones come in, and whenever I've got a moment just between, I read. I bring a lot of them home, and I get my ideas primarily, I guess, from other people. I suppose we all do that. In addition to the way I like to play, just to play around with graph paper. Nancy Halpern's influence, of course, at Shakertown leaves another avenue open that I've not had more time to explore, but that is to look at nature.
perhaps another tangent that I'd like to take.
So you took a January 83 workshop at Hilton Head under Jenny Barr, and then would you tell us this Nancy Halperin workshop that mm-hmm. you mentioned?
That took place in October of 83.
October?
Yes. At Shakertown, Pleasant Hill. And there were 14 of us who enjoyed Nancy's company for 4 days. And that was basically learning Nancy's technique and how she comes up with the design. And I went down there with the idea, I had another commission to do at the time, and I thought, oh, this is great, you know, I'll just work this commission right into Nancy's workshop. And as it turned out, and I knew when I got involved in my piece down there, that the basic design would work, but the colors that I was working with and the fabrics that I was working with would not be good for this other commission. So it was sort of like a dry run on that, and I have since done the other piece. And I showed the piece that I did at Nancy Halperin Workshop to the lady that I was commissioned to do this piece for, just to see what her reaction would be. And I was right, she didn't like it. It was just too busy for her. But she liked the design, so I reworked the same design in all solids, which is what she did. Very large, bold areas of color.
Can you describe this commission's for size?
It is a long, thin piece. It will hang in a very ultra-contemporary home out in Prospect. It's a home that, from the outside, looks like your standard ranch. And you walk inside and all kinds of second floors have been eliminated, and you know, a lot of very tall, angular cathedral ceilings. And this piece is going over the fireplace. And that wall comes up standard height on one side and then angles very steeply up to the left where it's met, you know, cathedral style here. So the piece is designed with areas of color running this way through it.
From left to right.
Left to right. No, right.
From right to left.
To left, going,
mm-hmm.
going
right.
up. The walls in the house are all very muted gray, and then she has used very large splashes of color throughout, and that's why I knew she wanted large. She's gotten away with use of more silk flowers and flowers in the rug, so she wanted a very simple, angular, geometric piece to do some breaking up there.
You pieced it on the machine?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And did you quilt it or
mm-hmm.
have it quilted?
Yeah, I've had it quilted.
And is it hanging?
Not yet, no.
And would you care to tell us the name of the woman?
Yes, her name is Jane Chilton. C-H-I-L-T-O-N.
Did you complete your workshop piece that you made at Nancy Halperin's?
Not yet. Still mulling over. It's completed except for borders, as far as the top being done. And I have the quilting design in mind, and this is going to be the piece that I will quilt.
Other than your Jenny Barr and your Nancy Halperin workshop, have you taken workshops under other quilters that are nationally known?
What I would call mini workshops. Whenever I go to quilt market, I take advantage of what they offer there. I've had color workshops under Jeff Gutchen and who else? Several years ago, I took quite a few. Oh, the same woman, Ellen. I can't remember her last name. This is terrible. She's a good friend of Katie's. Taken Judy Spahn. Took several vest design, clothing design workshops under Judy. Barbara Brockman, took a little mini stenciling workshop under her. I'm sure there were other Cheryl Radkin.
There were local workshops. Did you take advantage of any of those?
Yes, I did. Forgot about those. Nancy Crow took the one-day workshop under her. Did not get in Michael James's workshops, but I did go to his lecture. He was another one that sort of was the beginning of the inspiration for contemporary work for me. Really, I think one of my favorite all-time pieces is the one that he did, one of the circular pieces that he did that's now hanging in the corporate offices of IBM in Vermont. Beauty.
It's not Aurora, is it?
No, but it's of that series.
It was beautiful.
Yes, lovely.
Would you tell us the criteria of a good quilt in your mind?
What makes a good quilt?
First thing I think that people see, that I see in a quilt, is the color. I think color is very important. Secondly, the design, how you use that color. And I'd hate to say that those are first, second, and third would be craftsmanship. I'd hate to say that they would come in that order, because I think all of them have to work together for a good quilt. Now, I don't get sticky about, you know, bindings being filled and, you know, corners being perfectly mitered and that kind of thing, because I think the overall appearance, all three of those working together, doesn't have to be functional. Obviously, I don't make functional quilts. I think it's nice that they are. Love to see them around.
What makes a good quilt stitch?
Evenness. I don't think stitches even have to be terribly small. I do like to see them even and straight. I like to see a lot of.
Why do you make quilts?
That's a toughie, Joy. Why do we do this? Why do we cut up these little pieces and put them back together again? Well, in me, it's almost a twofold reason. One, it's my business. And secondly, it's a very pleasurable thing. Myself, as well as be involved with other people that do it. I don't consider that it's necessarily a heritage that I have to pass down. I don't have anybody to pass down, except this new great-grandniece that's coming up, maybe. Great-niece or nephew, whatever it's going to be. I don't feel that is real important. I know with a lot of people, some of the women that come into our classes, we usually ask them at the first class, why are you here? You're asking me the same question, why do I do this? Very often for them, it's something I've always wanted to do. And another answer that we get a great deal, particularly of women in their 30s and 40s, they want to have something to leave to their children. And I don't necessarily feel that much of heritage, not tradition. I guess maybe I can't boast. I can't say that my work is so good that it's going to be around 150 years from now and people are still going to enjoy it. I do it primarily for my own self-satisfaction.
Which do you prefer, piecing, appliquing, or quilting?
I'd have to say piecing.
What's a quilting bee?
That's where more than one woman quilts at the same time, I would say. You know, I mean,
on
it's not
the same piece?
In years past, I think that was the connotation of a quilting bee. Excuse me.
Have you ever attended a quilting bee?
No.
With the quilting party.
Quilting party is more like our Nancy Halper workshops, where people are gathered around doing their own thing in the company of one another.
And that you've done.
Quilting, yes, a great deal.
What's a Kentucky quilt?
I would say a Kentucky quilt is a quilt made by a Kentucky quilt maker, not necessarily of a Kentucky design.
Have you ever taught anyone to quilt?
Oh, yes.
Who?
Well, my mother. Not that she didn't already know before then, but I feel like I was instrumental in getting her back into quilting. I did, and of course, throughout, and I mean, when you say quilt, you're using that term collectively, are you not?
Yes.
Okay. Not just the quilt piece stitch. Right. Well, I've taught several classes, of course, through American Accents.
What classes have you taught?
Well, let's see, I've taught the Lone Star Quilt, Trip Around the World, Vest Making, Jacket Making.
Are these primarily machine-oriented, or?
Mm-hmm. They are. They are all machine. Machine piecing.
Do you enjoy teaching?
I love it. Sure do.
One of the things we ask at this point is, do you have any quilt books?
A few.
Well, at least you could answer this one. What are your favorites?
Oh, I don't have a favorite. I just think...
Well, what if you were going to give a quilt book to a very favorite grown niece? What book would you give her?
Well, it would depend on her skill level at the time.
You're going to introduce her to quilting. She's just really interested.
Well,
anxious.
It would have to be Diana Leon's Sanford Quilt or Marjorie Puckett's Patchwork Possibilities. I think those are both of great value to beginner quilters. They've been tested and proven to be very good for starting and inspiring beginning quilt makers and doing it right.
Well, what if your mother didn't own any quilt books, but she was deep into quilting and really enjoyed quilting, loved making quilts? Is there a prize quilt book that you would give her for a birthday?
I enjoy Carter Hawk and Myron Miller's book on American quilts and how to make them. I think it's, even though I've never made anything out of that book, I will often, if I walk past the book rack at the store, I'll often pick up that book and just thumb through it, read a little bit. I think it's well presented. I think it's a good cross-section of Americana-type quilts. And she not only goes into the history of those quilts and a little bit about them and the pictures in them, the quilts are displayed and what might be their original surroundings, and then she goes you one step further and offers you the patterns.
What quilt magazines do you subscribe to?
Quilt World and Quilter's Newsletter, which we get through the store. Of course, pick up random ones on the newsstand.
How do you feel about Lady Circle Patchwork Quilt magazine? It isn't one of the ones that you would...
No.
Gotcha.
No,
it is Carter
it's
Hall,
interesting. It's an interesting magazine. That's one that I pick up pretty regularly. Mm-hmm.
Do you ever take patterns from your quilt magazine?
No, but I take ideas.
What do you do with your finished quilts?
Mostly give them away, or sell them.
When did you start taking commissions or quilting for other people?
Well, see, we, again, I don't know how much of this involves the store or me personally. Well, the bank
Citizens
quilt.
Citizens Fidelity was your first.
Right.
And then the Lady in Prospect would have been your second. Have you any more in the books?
I have one other, yes. That just in the talking stages.
Do you want to tell us any more about that? Or?
Really not much to tell. It's a very... I'm finding that difficult areas to decorate are perfect for quilts because you can just make them in any size and shape that you want. And this house, again, is a very traditional house down in the Cherokee Triangle area that has a very long hallway. Stairway straight up and then lands as a small landing and goes up about four more steps to the second floor. Right at the top of that first landing, they have put the plumbing door, you know, the door to get into the plumbing. And it's all nicely molded all the way around, but it's not smack dab in the middle. It's just off to the side, leaves about 6 or 8 inches from the wall. And, you know, as you walk up the steps and look up, that's what you see. It's a very tall ceiling at that point. And all blank wall alongside. And so we're still talking about, I've done some preliminary designs, but really I'm not come on to anything solid yet for that particular wall.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. What would you do with an old quilt? When it began to wear out?
I would probably put it on a quilt rack or just love it the way it is rather than try to repair it.
How would you feel about it becoming a calico cat, a pillow, or a doorstop? Have you had any of your quilted items in a show or a contest or state fair?
No.
In your opinion, has there been any change in people's attitudes about quilting?
Oh gosh, we don't have enough tape for that. Oh gosh, but basically we covered it earlier when my mother said, you know, how can she sit around and cut up those little pieces and put them back together? Yes, it's changed.
Why do you think there's been a change?
Oh golly, that's a good one. I think that the change really came with what the Whitney, the exhibit at the Whitney Museum of Art in New York in 71, I think it was, 71 or 72, they hung an exhibit of quilts as art, and that was the real kiss that woke the sleeping princess.
Do you remember some of those quilt making names?
I don't. I'm sorry.
Do you think Michael James was part of that Renaissance? Or was he after that?
I wouldn't be surprised if he was.
I
can't either.
But I know the show you're referring to.
Uh huh.
And I've not heard that referred to at the time, but I think that's pivotal.
Well, that and then probably, you know, more artists looked at it, and Michael, I'm sure, is one of them. Looked at it as a true art form. And the idea no longer existed that only little old ladies would be doing this. And that you found them back in the woods and in Appalachia. Of course, in Appalachia, I think primarily too, is where it never truly died out. Those women continued. And then the bicentennial had a great influence, and I think that's what when I saw it primarily on the East Coast. I know when Appalachiana began to expand, they named their section over their recollections, and bicentennial really spurred that on. Mm-hmm. Every community felt that they had to make a quilt to commemorate the bicentennial. So I guess it was a combination of quilt making as an art form, as well as a renewed interest in an old art form, being quilt making, needlework. The reasons that I said earlier that we hear from some of our students is that, you know, they just wanted to have something to pass on. And, even if some of them make just one quilt or two quilts, one for each kid and stop, you know, they're happy.
What is the value of quilting?
I think the values change with each quilt maker.
What's the value to you?
Purely my own self-satisfaction in doing it. The value of what I do for something that hangs down at the bank, you know, I have gotten good feedback on that. The value there is that it pleases other people that look at it. We also sold a quilt to the Citizens Bank that hangs in their branch out on Westport Road, and it's a Dresden plate. And we still, and that's been hanging there over a year. And every once in a while, someone will come in the store and say, "Do you know there's a quilt that's hanging in the bank out on Westport Road?" And I say, "Yes, I do." And I just love going in there and looking at that quilt. So the value there is for their customers. You know, they're pleased when they have a good feeling when they walk into that place of business.
What are the favorite colors that you use? For you personally, what colors do you prefer?
I tend to go to the mauves, pinks, and rust, and mostly the warm colors.
Are there any colors you have a particular hard time finding?
The one I need for this particular piece, you know, at any one time, is always hard to find. I don't think so.
You don't find reds are difficult?
Mm-mm.
What thread do you prefer to use?
Cotton-covered polyester.
You have a certain brand name you prefer?
Not really.
What about that?
Do you like the Mountain Mist? Prefer that.
Polyester?
Uh-huh.
Polyester. What about needles? What size would you use?
I use an 8 or a 9. I would use a 10, but I lose my religion over trying to thread them.
Do you ever use a floor frame?
I've only tested a floor frame once. And, you know, just at Quilt Market, there was a woman that was selling a certain product and said, "Come sit down and try it on my frame." And I tried it. And if I were into quilting more, I think I would have very, you know, if I'm doing more of my own quilting, I would have a floor frame.
Do you usually use a hoop?
Mm-hmm.
This is tape 2, side 2, JDP number 13, interview with Midge Gate. I'm Joy Peterson. This is February 6, 1984. Midge, you and I were talking about some of the specifics as far as thread, needle, batting, and whatnot, floor frames. How have the materials used in quilting changed?
I don't know if they have. My grandmother always used cotton because that was all that was available to her there. It's still recommended today to use cotton. You know, it will last 150 years, but close to prove it. There certainly are people using other textiles in quilt making. And here again, I think we have to define whether or not we're talking about traditional quilt making, those that are going on a bed or, you know, be a throw or something like that, or a piece of art that needs a texture as well as a color in the design. And in that case, you know, I'm sure that made out of denims and the old Victorian quilts, and they use silk and satins and that kind of thing too. So basically, really, I don't think it has changed.
course, our bats are quite different.
Bats, of course, very different. No more wool bats or cotton bats as such.
And our polyesters have come to another generation. I mean, their first generation probably wasn't bonded.
That's right.
So probably they're able to enjoy that aspect, too, that we don't have the bearding that they did with the original polyester bat.
Right.
Do you applique?
Only when I have to.
You prefer pieces.
That's right.
Have you ever embroidered on any of your pieces?
No.
Do you sign your pieces?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I do.
And how?
I usually roll a piece of muslin into the typewriter and then applique that to the back of the quilt. Mainly because I don't embroider.
It has your name.
I should learn to do that.
What does it have on it? Your name and the date?
Name and the date and who I've made it for and the title of the quilt.
What's your favorite quilt pattern? Not necessarily that you've made, but that you enjoy looking at.
I really don't think I have a favorite. I guess the most versatile one would be the log cabin, because you can do so many, many different things with setting the off-center and kind of thing. But at that point, then I don't really call it a log cabin.
Do you belong to any quilters' organizations?
I don't, but I support two.
What two do you support?
Louisville Nimble Thimbles and Kentucky Heritage Quilt Society.
What older quilts do you own?
Well, I have two, and this is a funny story. I told you about my grandmother who made all the utilitarian quilts, and that my grandfather helped her in terms of making her templates. He went on a trip one time and came home with two quilts. And my mother said everybody in the family thought he'd gone out in the middle of the morning. Why on earth did you bring home two quilts made by someone else? And so the story goes that he realized that she had all these years made these quilts, and so he wanted her to have two that she didn't have to make. And I have those two quilts.
What pattern are they?
One is a trip around the world. The other is a dressing
room. Are they cotton?
Uh-huh.
Double bed size? What can you tell me about quilters in your family that we've not already discussed?
I think that's pretty well talked about.
Do you have any future projects you would like to put on the tape that we haven't talked about?
Nothing right now. There's one commission that I have coming up. It's just still in talking stages. I don't have anything major underway.
Other than the commissions that we talked about, are there other commissions that have been handled through American Accent that you would like to mention? I'm thinking primarily of one that I saw in a working stage that Patty Daniels did for Portland Federal. It was going to hang in Frankfurt. There are ones of that sort that perhaps you could mention here that have had some, well, some influence of American Accents on them, perhaps.
Well, of course, we do a lot of designing for our customers, and those quilts go into private homes. what we do is generally go out to a person's home, look at the room the quilt is going into, gather color schemes, swatches of rug or tile or drapery fabrics and upholstery fabrics and that kind of thing. And so we do a great deal of that. And I am involved almost exclusively in that, where I do the basic footwork and the design work, and then I farm it out to ladies in the community as well as some Amish communities that we work with that do the sewing. I'm glad you mentioned that one about Patty for Cumberland. I had forgotten that. We put that one and two for citizen. I'm trying to think if there's any other that going into commercial space have plans to contact Humana and try to do something for their new building.
While we were talking, I had a couple of thoughts that came through my mind that I wish you would elaborate on if you care to. And that is that your lifestyle, in some ways, is quite different from the lifestyle of the older quilter in Kentucky. That is, in two respects that came to my mind. One was that at one time I thought you were learning to fly and hoping to become a pilot. And another, you mentioned taking Nautilus. I wonder if you tell us a little bit about that side of your life.
Well, I'm just always looking for something new and different to do, I suppose. Flying came through a friend that owns his own plane, and I flew with a great deal and just loved it. And again, those challenges present themselves to me, and I think I have to try it. Like what my Tomiko friend did to me, you know, in the way of retailing. And yes, my lifestyle might be a little bit different in that respect from someone who is drawn to quilt making. It's certainly a more sedentary hobby, and maybe that's why I feel, in fact, Pat and I were talking about this last night. You know, I need the exercise, I need a reason to get out there and do exercise. Can then afford the time to sit between 9 p.m. to 8 a.m. to make quilts. Being single, too, I'm sure has a very different... my life is a lot more free than someone with a family might be.
When did you start Nautilus? Just yesterday?
Yesterday. Yeah. Played also on our racquetball. Used to play a great deal of racquetball. And then the gal that I played with here a lot in Louisville took her skiing February 2 years ago, and she had a bad fall and wrenched her knee, which I don't know if you know anything about racquetball, but it's a very quick change of direction type sport, and so that put her on waivers for a while. And I do enjoy skiing. In fact, I had to get my ski gear out of the living room before you came this morning. But I do enjoy a lot of athletic
activities. Cross country or downhill?
Both. I do both.
Where?
Well, we don't do too much of it around here, but when I can, I go out to Paoli. When I lived in Maryland, that was the nice thing about living in Maryland. You know, you could throw your skis in the back of the car in 5 hours, you'd be up in Pennsylvania mountains and do some good skiing there. Last year, I skied out at Steamboat Springs and did a good bit of cross country. Absolutely beautiful. Just that's when you wish you had more of the tools, you know, the scenery out there, and then to capture that and put it in textile would just be marvelous. I feel the same way about water. I enjoy water sports, and of course, as I told you earlier, sail all the way down the Virgin Islands. And,
have you ever done any scuba?
No, I haven't.
Snorkel.
Mm-hmm.
Do you jog?
No, I don't.
Play tennis?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I just thought it would be interesting to mention those things because, of course, as you and I know, so many of the women that we see taking classes in American Accent
mm-hmm.
don't have this
mm-hmm.
facet of their life opening up for them. Well, we certainly are appreciative of the time and the consideration that you've given us on this tape. I'm glad to give you time here for anything else you'd like to add. If not, I just want to thank you.
Well, thank you for asking me. I don't know that I'm worthy of the archives, but...
We think you're eminently worthy.
I appreciate it very much.
Thank you.